Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, March 31st, 2016. Tonight's main science topic, I'll be talking about comets and their effects on Earth. So I'll go through some historical examples and then talk about the theoretical part of this, because we had two little comets that came by Earth about 10 days ago. It was actually Monday, March 21st, and then Tuesday, another smaller one came by. Very, very close. Definitely had some effects. I already talked about this. I'll be talking about some more tonight. So that's the main science topic, and then also giving other historical comets that are relatively recent. The first thing I want to talk about, and I don't want to go into politics, the first thing that people do whenever I mention something like this, then they start trying to go into political analysis and things like this. I don't want to do any political analysis here. There's a million people doing that, and, you know, whatever. The one thing you can say is true is that this summer is going to turn into a cauldron of false flag events, fake terrorism. The neocons are going to be going crazy trying to create as much chaos as possible to make you think that they're important and they can rule and all of this other stuff. It's really going to be a mess this summer. So my advice is to get prepared, and you just have to be able to take care of yourself. I got a kick out of John Morris' show I was on yesterday, and a guy calls in and he goes, everything's going really pretty good. And I'm like, what? He goes, yeah, I moved to New Jersey like a long time ago, and all my friends, we live in an upper middle class or upper scale neighborhood, and everybody's doing really good. And I'm like, you know, I can't stand these people. They live in their own little la-la land. They don't go out into the rest of the country or the world or other third world countries. And this is what makes the ugly American ugly. So they have no clue what's going on in the rest of the world. And so, no, things are not going well for the average person. For the lower 10% of the people, things are going really bad. This guy goes, I would recommend that all young people move to an upscale community. It's like, hey, buddy, young people can't even get a job at McDonald's with a college education. So I don't think that a lot of these kids are going to be moving to upscale communities. You know, it's just people are simply in la-la land. But the point is, this summer, things are going to come unglued. There's going to be racial distortions, police against the people on the street, and just and a lot of this is going to be created. So all I'm saying is try and stay out of the path of all of this. Be prepared. Have your water, food, all of the things that you can supply for yourself, be ready. That's all I can tell you. And then just try and stay out of the action, so to speak. So that's guaranteed that that's going to happen. The thing is that you don't know where this is going to happen. And, you know, it's very strange. There's been no real terrorism in the United States. There's been a lot of false flag, theater shootings, school shootings that were completely orchestrated, but there hasn't been any real terrorism since 9/11 in 2001. So, in what's coming up this summer, what I'm saying is a lot of orchestrated, where they send in actors or you know, people to create problems and then arrest them, and then they get, you know, they are allowed to leave right away. People are all over this. People are observing this. People are recording, you know, crisis actors all the time. People are up to the bag of tricks that are going on. So, but for the average person, just try and stay out of the way. Stay out in the middle of nowhere. If you can, you know, go on vacation and, you know, go to some remote area. But, anyway, I don't want to dwell on that too much, but it's very important to be prepared. And, you know, even if there's natural disasters, you don't have a clue where this is going to happen. Every time there's a natural disaster, I should say this, the people are surprised, like, oh, how could this happen where I live? And it's like, well, you know, there's really no way of telling with natural disasters. So if you're not prepared and something happens, well, you're not prepared. So you shouldn't be real surprised. And I've always said this, when you prepare, it's not for, say, a flood. It's not for anything specific. It's not for high winds or tornadoes specifically. It's for everything. Preparation is the same for everything, whether it's a celestial object coming through the solar system that wreaks havoc on the Earth, or whether it's some man-made issue, or whether it's, you know, a volcano that's 1,000 miles away and it's causing problems with the weather. No matter what it is, there's no way to predict, or there's no way to really imagine that it's going to happen to you. And so that's the big surprise. Oh, how could this happen to me? Oh, goodness, what makes you so special that, you know, natural catastrophes or man-made catastrophes would never happen to you? What makes you think you're so special? You know, that, gee, it just shouldn't happen to you. Well, let me tell you that every day things happen to people who don't expect it. So be prepared, and then if something happens, which I certainly hope it doesn't, but if it happens, then you just go into the mode of taking care of yourself. That's simple. A couple quick announcements here. DARPA, the Defense Research Agency, has called out for proposals, and this is very strange. They want you or anybody to look around you, whatever you see. I mean, you might see shoes, you might see, other things. You might see a home computer, you might see a paperclip. You might see a pen. You might see a calculator. Okay, what DARPA wants you to do is create weapons with whatever you see, and then send them the idea, so that they can. Of course, they claim that the whole program is to understand what violent terrorists could do with common everyday things. But believe me, the real reason is that so they can mix it into the military development processes to develop military weapons. They want it for the home team as much as they do for trying to figure out what other people are doing out there. So anyway, also, NASA came out and was looking, they're throw out some money numbers, which is always the ploy, and they're looking for lighter-than-air dirigibles. Now, dirigible is like the Zeppelin and the other lighter-than-air, you know, like the Goodyear blimp is a good example. But NASA wants people to submit ideas. And I just want to tell you, if you get excited about any of these programs and you go, oh, gee, we're going to design a dirigible, a lighter-than-air craft of some kind and send the plans off to NASA, hey, nobody's ever going to see a dime. They do this all the time. They suck the ideas out of the people. Engineers are out there thinking they're going to make millions of dollars and get a grant from NASA. Now, never happens. Never has, never will. This is just a big scam. This is like the DARPA deal to extract ideas out of the public. NASA and the military solicit ideas at conferences. I've been to these. And the people are there in mass giving their ideas. And ultimately, NASA develops the program internally, spits those people and their ideas out, They take the ideas, excuse me, they don't spit those out, but they spit the people out, and they never get a dime. That's been going on for a long time. So don't get sucked into that one. On the same note, NASA, after Putin of Russia announced that they were going to develop nuclear rockets for travel in outer space, NASA comes along and goes, gee, we should do that too. Maybe we could get to Mars in like 3 days. And I'm thinking, oh my goodness. They have no plans. NASA has no plans. They have no experience, no designs. This is what I call hype tripe. That's the best word I can think. And, you know, they just say, oh, we're going to do this. We're going to get to Mars faster. They don't have anything going on. This just came in yesterday that an object slammed into Jupiter or came very near Jupiter. Yes, and it's very disgusting to see the so-called science which surrounds an event like this. Jupiter, the reality is that Jupiter has an electrical field that's created by an excess current of protons. It has fusion in its atmosphere. It's a small star. But they treat Jupiter as if it were a planet. It's just this inert object sitting out there all by itself. And so anyway, when the object comes near, it discharges the local capacitor at Jupiter, and therefore it lights up like a comet. So no big surprise. Probably a very small object, and this literally happens all the time. It just turns out that somebody caught it on film. And so they saw the object apparently visually and then took some pictures. So thank goodness for that. But the science, the so-called science explanations that come out of standard science, just totally ridiculous. I guess what can you say about that? The Vatican and comets. So I just want to say something about Earth Day. I'm getting feedback from some groups that are actually doing Earth Day. They're following some of my suggestions that I put on my webpage, and that is to have a free living seminar. In other words, when you go to the department store or the big box store and you buy something, okay, you bring it home, it has some use in your house. But remember that a long time ago, there was no big box store. There was no commercial place to go and buy things. So people had to create everything that they needed for the house, for their clothes, for everything. So what these students are doing is they're going out and finding the solutions that either were used before or creating new solutions. But this is the thing I wanted to mention, is that the administration of one of the schools came back and said they wanted hands-on type of displays for Earth Day. And what does that mean? That means real things, not just think of things and write a list. No, that's fine. Anybody can do that. But actually go out and do it. You know, if you're going to make clothes out of sheep's wool, then go out and get the sheep's wool, spin it, clean it, put it in, possibly put some dye in it, various things. During my trip to Peru this past winter, when I discovered the Nazca lines, the antenna complex, fractal antenna complex design resolution for the Nazca lines, I happened to go to a small town where they made Peruvian, cloth, and then blankets and, bags and sweaters, all of the other things that are made in Peru. And so, luckily, I was there at a time when they had a little demonstration. And it was very interesting. They showed how they made the dyes for the wool, the alpaca wool. And so they mainly have those animals for, not for meat. You would think, well, gee, they keep them for meat, but not really. They have the milk that comes from the animals, but they mainly are there for the wool. And, of course, the Peruvians live in a cold climate, and because it's mountainous and cold and dry and sometimes rainy, sometimes very rainy in some of these regions of Peru. But they showed how they made the dyes for the alpaca wool. And that was very interesting. They had plants, they had ants, they had, I mean, literally little insects. They had all of these different things. One of them, they took some material in their hand, the palm of the hand, rubbed it on there, and then they put some lemon drops on it, and it turned to that brilliant red. And so characteristic of Peruvian artwork is that brilliant red. So anyway, they were showing how to produce that red tint that goes into the colors, and then they weave this all together, and it could take up to a month to make like a display. Very intricate, and they produce these by hand, by memory, and so they, and it takes them a long time to learn how to these trades. And the older women teach the younger women, and all the way down to the young girls are there, and so they, this is part of their livelihood. But these are people that live literally off the land, and of course they try and sell some of their goods, make some money to better their lives, etc. But there's a case where those traditional ways of making clothing, for example, are, you know, probably thousands of years old. The various techniques and, you know, the animal husbandry, everything that goes with it. But back to Earth Day, the response that came back from the administration of one of the schools was to have hands-on displays, you know, to literally go out and do this. So I really like that. I like that input. There's so many things. I mean, just look at all of the things we use in daily life around the kitchen, bowls and cups and dishes and, you know, utensils to cook with. And the Native Americans used to use hot rocks. And here's how they cooked. They took a leather skin that was supported by sticks, and they put their water, put water and then the vegetables and meat or whatever was going to go in the stew in the leather, basically a leather bag. And then they would heat up a fire and heat up rocks to, you know, of course, really hot. And they would put those rocks into the stew. That's how they would cook, because they didn't have containers. They didn't have steel containers. And, of course, wooden containers wouldn't last long for cooking. So that's how they cooked. And, you know, that was, you know, that's what they did. So all of these techniques, I've got some books on old ways of living, you know, like frontier-style living. And it's just has always interested me how these people did things, because they didn't have tools. They, you know, they had very few tools. They may have had an axe and a knife, very basic tools, and that's what they lived with. So they made, their plows were made out of wood. The straps that went on the horses were made out of leather, cowhide, rawhide, or whatever you said. Rawhide being being tanned, like we see modern leather, very flexible, etc. That's rawhide is very stiff, and with use it becomes flexible. But anyway, that's something that Earth Day is about, basically saving the Earth and reducing your effects on the planet. So how do you actually live on this planet without destroying your environment? I mentioned a few weeks ago that you could live in an environment and actually make it better. The ground would be better. You put fertilizer, you put compost back into the soil. And actually, by living there, you make your surroundings better. You know, you feed the animals, you have bird feeders, etc. And so it's a harmony, living in harmony with the planet. Okay, now talking about the Vatican and comets. A long time ago, and many people know now, that the Vatican has some telescopes. How interesting. Isn't it nice that the Pope likes to look at stars? Except, they don't look at stars. They look at comets. The telescopes, and this has been a very big misinformation campaign, that the Vatican telescopes somehow look for deep space or the Big Bang or, you know, something like that. No. The Vatican telescopes are designed to look at comets. And one might wonder, well, gee, why would they look at comets if they're just stupid little snowballs and they can't hurt anything, and maybe one that's every million years once glances and hits Earth or something like that? No, they know fully well that I'm correct about comets. And when Hale-Bopp came into the solar system, and it was first discovered literally in 1991, if you want to know the entire story about that, look for my July 23rd, 2015 release regarding Hale-Bopp, the 20th year anniversary, and the Harrington expedition that I did a year ago, literally about a year ago now, and the and what I called the Planet X update. Now, what I discovered was that the object that Harrington did discover in 1991 under the contract NASA search for Planet X, Harrington literally discovered Planet X. What was it? It was the nucleus of Hale-Bopp. So, I mean, that's what he found, and I proved that a year ago, less than a year ago, and released it in that publication. But the point about the Vatican is that they were very tuned to this also. That's the time, 1991, that the Vatican went out and built their first telescope in Arizona, staffed it with university-grade astronomers, and I happen to know some of them, and that's how I knew what was going on. But the telescope was to look at comets, and it was specifically to look at Hale-Bopp. That's what that comet or that telescope was used for. That's what it was designed for. It was built to, and why should the Vatican be interested in comets? Well, that particular comet had a near-direct collision course with Earth. And so I'm not going to rehash all of this on this show. There's a lot of people who are listening to this show possibly for the first time or were not aware of that. But the issue is that the Vatican has built two new telescopes, and they're designed to look at comets. Now, a comet telescope is very, very different than a regular telescope. Most telescopes look at an extremely small patch of the sky. There's a big mirror, that great big mirror or conglomeration of mirrors. It could be two mirrors, it could be, which is called a binocular, or it could be multiple mirrors. All look typically at an extremely small patch of the sky, but comets are different. They're very big. So you need light gathering power, and comets are typically very bright. So you don't need that light gathering is distributed over a much wider area of the sky. That's the point. So a telescope that's designed to look at comets is totally different than a telescope that's meant to look at galaxies or distant deep space objects. It's a, comet telescope is a wide field of view, and it's what you call bright sky. In other words, it gathers a lot of light. And then also you have things like spectrometers. You have equipment that is very much tuned to looking at the spectroscopy of comets, redshifts, things like that, which I predicted. Now, typically in standard science, comets should not have any redshifts at all. And so what I proved is that because of the electric field, the non-uniform electric field around comets, comets do exhibit redshifts. And so the deeper into the towards the nucleus that you look, the greater the redshift. So that's one way of proving that the non-uniform electric field is in fact causing the redshift. I mean, these are very provable items when you have the correct equipment and you know what to do with that equipment. come in tier two science, the fairy tale science that's pawned off to you by NASA. They don't publish any of this stuff. That's one of the big problems. On my radio show, I try and inform the public about these issues. But unfortunately, you'll never see it in standard science, and therefore, you know, you won't, even if you went to get a PhD in astronomy, you wouldn't see this. So, anyway, I wanted to preface my little discussion tonight dealing with comets, near passages with Earth, and the Vatican relative to comets. And also, you have to understand that the Vatican control is a lot more than just papal. It's a lot more than just the Pope trying to herd the sheep of Catholic. And also now it's more ecumenical, and so there's more like Protestants and Baptists. They're all kind of considered Christians. So the Pope is somewhat the, oh, kind of the nominal leader of all of them through the ecumenical movement of a number of years ago. But their real interest has been in science. And so, at any rate, one of their big interests is in astronomy and primarily in comets, because they know that the comets are the dangerous things that can affect Earth, not by colliding with Earth, but by passing by Earth. And, you know, the big ones, and they realize all this. They understand that my science is completely 100% correct. But they don't want you, the public, to understand this. Okay, so let's move into these two small comets that pass by. And now, I've talked about these before, so I'm not going to repeat. Listen to last week's show. I went through some details about the noctiluminescent clouds. The air glow, which is the upper atmosphere, just a glow at the outside edge of the Earth's atmosphere. And I briefly mentioned the winter storms, but now I want to concentrate more on these winter storms that raged across the United States. These were, I'm finding out because of just personal contact, I'm finding out that these were horrendous winter storms that followed on the heels of those comets. And how exactly does this happen? Well, the comets are, remember, a comet nucleus is what? You know, a very small, possibly a kilometer across. So that's not very big. But what is the electrical size? Now, let me give an example of electrical size. And I did this with my NASCA lines paper. I talked about the interferometer antenna designs, where you take a series of small antennas, or they're really not so small, but relative to the overall size, they're relatively small, and the antennas, and you put them into a pattern, like one of the more famous patterns is a Y. So you have these antennas, they're radio antennas, so they're parabolic discs, round antennas on stands, and you put them out in a pattern. Now, even though that whole area is not covered by antenna, you get the effective size of an antenna that big by putting these in an array. And so that's a real good example of electrical size being very different than physical size. Now, in the terms of comets, let's do something here. Let's talk about the Earth and the Moon. Okay, the Earth and the Moon. The Moon is a quarter million miles away. But the Moon is only a couple thousand miles in diameter, and Earth is around 8,000 miles in diameter. But there's a distance of a quarter million miles between them. But electrically, they connect together, and that bridges them together. So effectively, the Earth-Moon electrical system, the physical part of it, is a quarter million miles across. That's way, way, way bigger than Jupiter. Now, Jupiter has moons, and those moons interact electrically with Jupiter. So that makes Jupiter's physical size, you know, it's about 10 times the diameter of Earth. But the The electrical size of Jupiter is enormous. And when you start that electrical discharge in the sunward direction and in the anti-sunward direction, the electrical size of Jupiter can span the entire solar system. So physical size and electrical size are two different things. Anyway, the fact that these comets, and of course standard science only talks about physical size, and they think, oh, these little snowballs, you know, they're not very big. They fail to realize that the electrical size, they don't understand this, of course. I mentioned when Siding Spring came by Mars, it was 87,000 miles away from the planet Mars. And Mars is a smaller planet than the Earth, just a couple thousand miles across, just a bit bigger than our moon. And it has a couple little teeny moons out there, so, and it has a very faint atmosphere. So Mars is pretty much a very insignificant planet out there in the middle of outer space. But electrically, when this comet Siding Spring came by 87,000 miles away, it interacted strongly with the Martian atmosphere and the electric field. As I said, we saw it from Earth literally lighting up like a light bulb, growing a comet tail. And so the Mars became very excited electrically, so it became very large electrically. Okay, so these are very important topics. And the if you study my plasma discharge comet model in the various books, you're going to realize that this is a very important discovery that I made, that electrical size is very different than physical size. So, for example, when the moon of Earth, our moon, when it comes between us and the sun, all of a sudden we're not that big anymore, because the cross-section relative to the line directed from the sun is very small. Now it's not much bigger than the moon itself. And the moon blocks the solar wind, is acting as a comet. And so now what happens, after about 2 days after the new moon, that's when the moon is directly between Earth and the sun, as the moon moves away, all of a sudden that blockage, basically the comet shape, the electrical comet shape around the moon, moves away, and that might be 100,000 miles across. So it takes a couple days for the moon to move away. And now that pulse from the solar wind just comes blasting in and hits Earth. The same thing happens during full moon, but it's not as pronounced. In that case, Earth is blocking the solar wind. And as the moon, as the Earth moves out from in front of the moon, between the moon and the sun, the moon is the one that gets the shock. But in doing so, it's a trigger mechanism that can influence weather on Earth. And that's exactly what happened. On the 21st, I believe we had the full moon. 2 days later, we had the Earth passing from that state. And also, the comets had already passed. They were past Earth. They had zipped through. They had gone away. But all of these combined factors introduced the electrical energy that drove those tremendously powerful winter storm systems all across the United States, from the American Southwest all the way up into Canada. And I talked to people, and there are many of you out there that lived through those storms. Oh, goodness. Feet and feet of snow, extremely high winds. When I made my prediction that regarding the effects of these comets, weather was one of my primary predictions. I had people write to me and said, gee, Mr. McCanny, you better be careful. You're making these predictions, and if they don't come true, you could have egg all over your face. Well, let me tell you something. This particular prediction, and I'm very careful about when I make predictions, this particular prediction was almost a no-brainer. it was very easy to see that these comets coming within a couple million miles of Earth were going to affect it. If sighting Spring, a very small comet, 87,000 miles away from Mars, created a significant measurable effect, and on little planet Mars, then these comets, which are literally about the same size, but two of them coming in with 3 million miles within 3 million miles of Earth, certainly were going to have some visible effects. And they did. They had the air glow very heavy in the southern hemisphere. I still have that picture up in my homepage, so you can go see it at the very top of the homepage. I have to take that down. I've got some new pictures that came in that are just fantastic. And so those will be posting in the next day or so. But go to my homepage, jmccsci.com, and look at those pictures of the air glow. One of the pictures taken at down in Atacama, Chile, the evening air glow matches the setting sun. That's how bright it was. And once again, this is the electrical connection with the upper atmosphere, literally lighting up like a light bulb, the same green color as the comets. And so, anyway, now what I want to do is pass along to some other comets that came close to Earth. Hale-Bopp is a comet that passed not really close to Earth, but it was in the solar system for a period of 6 years, almost unprecedented. Well, it is unprecedented. It's the longest visible comet, naked eye visible comet in history that we're aware of. I would say that actually historical comets, Venus is, and I give full credence to the ancients when they talk about Venus being a comet, and it was in the solar system for a period of 40 years or more, probably actually hundreds of years. But it was had some very drastic effects on Earth. But I don't want to go in too much into the ancient comets. I want to talk more about the modern comets. And so action at a distance, Hale-Bopp was able to discharge the solar capacitor, driving up the energy of the sun. The sun, therefore, gave out a lot more electrical energy. Earth was involved in this. And we had some of the most horrific cyclonic storms in the history of planet Earth. 300-plus mile-an-hour winds. The sun was just going bonkers. There was a double solar maximum in the year 2000. What was it, 2000 to 2002? There was a double solar maximum, something that has never, ever been recorded in history. Going back to the Middle Ages, when Galileo first started counting sunspots, there was a double maximum. And then, after Hale-Bopp left the solar system, the energy of the sun took a nosedive. We spent 6 years, and still the sun is not back to normal. So it depleted the sun's capacitor energy bank, basically. And it's going to take some while for that to build up. And that is something that's typical after comets pass through the solar system. Historically, the comets discharge the solar capacitor, and then we go into kind of a mini ice age, actually. So the Arctic ice sheet and the Antarctic ice sheets are actually growing, contrary to what the NASA announcements are saying recently. The actual content, the actual ice caps are growing, have been growing for the last couple of years. They're not being depleted by, global warming or something like that. They're actually increasing. And so, but this is a result of Hale-Bopp leaving the solar system and the sun being depleted of its solar capacitor, which is part of its energy source. This is the sun is basically a fusion engine, and it has to be replenished constantly with hydrogen, because if not, there's not enough matter in the sun to continue burning for 4.5 billion years or even a billion years. That's one of the problems I solved. I show this in my DVD course, DVD number 4, the University Level Astronomy, Astrophysics, and Space Science course. That's one of the problems I show in there, and how you can actually calculate that if you took all of the mass in the sun, expended it by converting it to E equals mc squared energy into light energy, there's not enough mass in the sun to last 4.5 billion years. So this idea that the sun started billions of years ago and it's been burning ever since with core fusion is just, I mean, it can't even be correct. It's just ludicrous. And so, at any rate, the sun has to be replenished continually with hydrogen. Well, where does that come from? That comes from outside the solar system. So the sun, basically in the galactic proton-supported wind of the galactic center, which is doing the same thing as our sun. It's a proton-supported wind. Our sun is acting as a comet accumulating hydrogen that's in the universe, in this part of the universe where our galaxy is. So anyway, the sun is literally acting as a comet. But very important to understand what happened with Hale-Bopp. Comet Lexel is very interesting. Comet Lexel is the comet that has come closest to Earth in all history. And furthermore, it was a fairly significant comet in size. Not a lot is known because this was in 1770, July 1st, 1770. Now, what's really interesting is something I have done in my days since I have taught astronomy at the university level. Let me go into this a little bit, but first I'm going to preface it with the point I'm trying to make. A lot of the information we have about old comets, about old astronomical events, have been, let's say, sequestered or taken out of the astronomy books. I have made a point of collecting old astronomy books and astronomy texts and things like that. They are simply taken out. So say a guy goes to get a PhD in astronomy today, or astrophysics, or space science, the three big topics that would cover outer space. You get to throw in there extraterrestrial geology, things like that. But the records, or SETI, the search for intelligent life in the universe, all of these subjects, the historical information has been totally cut out and replaced with basically very little, if only sparse information. And the real information simply doesn't exist anymore. In 1991, I did an astronomy study. 1991, I was teaching astronomy at the university level, and the textbook companies came around to me as being the person who would select the textbooks that would be used. I probably had 20 textbook companies, and of course I was beset with the task of trying to decide which astronomy book would be appropriate for the class level that I was teaching. So anyway, to make a long story short, what I did is actually described in my Atlantis to Tesla, the Colburn Connection book. What I did is I said, I'm going to get all of these astronomy books. Why not? They're free. These guys want to give them to me so I can look at them, and that's what I'm going to do. And select one of them for the astronomy class that I was teaching. So I got all of these, and I started looking through them, and I thought, wow, this is going to take a little bit of manpower. And so every semester with my students in the astronomy class, because I'd been teaching this for a bit, every semester I had the students do a project. and they got to choose their projects. For example, one guy one time took the whole class out to the airport. He was a mechanic on Boeing 747s. And so he took us all out to a hangar at the airport, and we all had to get security passes, etc., and go in, and we got to walk up on the scaffolding and walk around this 747 with its, I don't know how many millions of miles they have to really take it all apart. And they had the outer skin off. You could see all of the hydraulics that go around the outside. You know, you look at this plane and you think, well, there's a couple of engines, there's a gas tube, there's a gas tank, and that's it. No. Those walls of the airplane are filled with tubes and hydraulics and all kinds of stuff. It's unbelievable. And so anyway, then we went inside the 747, and they had everything gutted out. It was just an empty shell. So anyway, this is one of the students' projects, and I'll never forget that because, I mean, they had the engines down on the ground. They had them working on. It was incredible to see a 747 completely stripped down like that and being worked on. I mean, it was just absolutely amazing. But anyway, so the students got to do these projects, and mainly, typically, they were doing with engineering or space or flight or something. Okay, so I said, I'm going to take these 20 textbooks of astronomy, and we're going to rotate these through the students. And the students are going to get into groups, and one group is going to take, for example, Venus, one will take Jupiter, one will take galaxies, one will take, you know, origin of the universe, origin of the solar system, various topics. Each group would take a topic, and they would go through all of the textbooks. This was their project, and I had forms that they would fill out, so it was all organized. And they would also discover who wrote the books and who edited the books and who cross-edited the books and refereed the books. And it turned out to be one giant happy family of authors. And these guys were from NASA, other universities. And the one that would write one book would edit the other book or referee the other book and vice versa. So this was one big happy family of astronomy. And so what you found was that there was a consistency amongst all of the textbooks. And these were, you know, Macmillan and all the big textbook companies out there selling these textbooks. And they wanted a consistency that came from officialdom. So it was really an eye-opener. And that was the source. I then got funding. And this, I did a professionally produced video that was funded through a grant that I got from the college system. And it resulted in a video called Astronomy for the 90s. You can see that. You can see me back in 1991 as I was presenting this video. And it's professionally done. We had a professional producer come in, filmed everything. We got footage from NASA. We got all kinds of stuff contributed and to for visuals as I talked through this. And basically, the story was the same story as today. Here we are, 25 years later, and nothing has changed in the theoretical world of astronomy. So my point here is that for a long, long time, the information regarding historical aspects of astronomy have been edited out of any visibility. So people go up and like this Michael Brown yo-yo, at Caltech or something, and he's talking about Planet Nine, you know. When he first came out, I could tell that guy was so green behind the ears, and I've seen this over and over going to American Geophysical Union meetings, etc., that the new PhD astrophysics, astronomy, space science students are just completely unaware of anything. So anyway, I don't want to divert too far on that. But my point is that There's a lot of old information, for example, on Comet Lexel, which doesn't appear anymore. And basically, there were a lot of effects. There were earthquakes, volcanoes. There were other effects that occurred during that time. Also, the comet, there was a big comet in 1811. I think the Great Comet of 1861, there was another one. These were big comets that came through the solar system, not necessarily very near to Earth, but there's some relationship between these comets and other events. For example, the large St. Louis earthquake that occurred was simultaneous with the passage of a large comet. Not near Earth, but there again, these are the electrical effects. These are the shock waves that come back down, and we've seen this before. We've seen, for example, when hurricanes make landfall, especially the big hurricanes over in the Pacific. This happened in Hawaii with Hurricane Daniel. This happened with many typhoons that made landfall in Japan and in China, where as soon as the hurricane, typhoon is what they call them in the Pacific, but basically it's a hurricane, cyclonic storm. As soon as they make landfall, there's a major earthquake, and this repeats and repeats and repeats. We saw this with Hurricane Daniel in Hawaii, and Hurricane Daniel was destined to destroy the island of Hawaii. It was a major hurricane. The people were preparing. Civil defense was out. They had all the roads closed. People had bought, you know, supplies and water. And Hurricane Daniel comes in, and it short-circuited. I watched it live. And it was coming in, and the people, this was interesting because the Hawaiian people on the national news were saying, don't worry about it. Hurricanes never come to Hawaii, the big island. Other islands, yeah, but not the big island of Hawaii where Daniel was headed to. And they said, no, they never get here. And that's historically from Hawaiian lore. That's apparently why they liked it there, because they didn't have a problem with hurricanes. Hurricane Daniel shorted out to an island that is forming off of the southern coast of Hawaii. And I saw it. It jumped about 40 miles. The eye jumped. It shorted out, and instantaneously there was about a 5 on the Richter scale, the new Richter scale, earthquake right there. Boom. And so anyway, what's going on? Well, when the electrical current that's supporting that storm shorts out to land, the current goes down in the ground. So anyway, my point in this entire discussion is that electrical effects cause earthquakes. Not all earthquakes are caused by comets. So don't misquote me by saying that. But when large electrical effects, including discharges of the solar capacitor or passing comets, etc., can cause electrical effects that can cause earthquakes. If you look in the standard literature today, what you will find is discussion, endless, mindless discussion of comets. What if they hit Earth? And it has absolutely nothing to do with the real effects of comets. So there again, you're dealing with people that have no idea what's going on. They claim to be the experts. University-educated people really are some of the most disgusting people I have met in my life. They read a textbook. I call them textbook geniuses. They read a textbook, they get an A, and wow, are they smart. You know, it's just disgusting. And the higher up the ladder you go, the worse it is. And, you know, and especially once they start getting a paycheck, they're locked in because they don't want to rock the boat. They don't want to even think about rocking the boat because their paycheck sitting there in their retirement and the house payment and the kids going to college and everything else. No, it's thinking is not an option. Putting out some new idea or considering that Jim McCaney's work is correct is not an option. And by the way, this is not just in space science, astronomy, the world of comets, or anything like that. I mean, that's certainly there. But in the world of mathematics, the same thing. Everybody's tippy-toeing around my mathematical work, because they don't, nobody wants to, you know, it's like the, nobody wants to let the genie out of the bottle, because all of their paychecks could be at risk. Now let me diverge a little bit into statistics of earthquakes. And if you look up, in fact, you can do this, look up historical earthquakes. There's various references to that online. You can look at all of the dates historically of major earthquakes around the globe. These are the big ones that had, you know, large kill rates that were very well known about, etc. And if you look at those, some of them you can pick out are associated with comets. But a lot of them, or most of them, are not associated with comets. And this is my point, that you cannot go running around, jumping up and down, talking about solar flares or comets or anything else causing earthquakes, because, and I'm saying this from a statistical point of view. So what we need is direct data. For example, the Tunguska event, which was in Russia, we have very good data. But it wasn't a comet impact, it was a local electrical discharge. And so when you go to the Tunguska site, which I personally have not, but I've talked to people who have been there. The Russian scientists that I worked with back in the mid-90s had been there, they had studied that, and they came away with the conclusion that it was an electrical discharge phenomenon. So anyway, that's the story, that it was an electrical discharge, and they didn't know where it came from. That's why they were very interested in my work, because now they could understand why a passing comet, which it clearly was, because of the air glow. Now, that's a very good case of very similar type of events occurring in Russia. The air glow in that region of Siberia, Tunguska, before the impact or the electrical discharge, which blew down all those trees for 20 miles around, all in a circular pattern, blown outwards, before that, the sky lit up. And for nights on end, they had the air glow, which is the exact same thing that happened with the two little comets. So there's no question that the Tunguska event was a comet passing by Earth. It discharged the solar capacitor. And remember that when you're very close eye to eye with a comet, when you're that close that the actual comet is not visible like it is at a distance. We saw Hale-Bopp, for example, at a distance, and you see this nicely formed comet. That's why, for example, when the Noah's flood was going on, they were immersed in this comet, and they really didn't see the comet because they were in the comet. They were in the comet tail for a period of 40 days and 40 nights. So anyway, I just want to remind you, I'm about out of time here, but I want to remind you, go to my webpage, jmccsci.com, all the water filters. I have the new water filters for animals and horses, all the water filters for people, the GF filters to take out everything, plus all my books, etc. And something a lot of people are buying is the everything package, is the complete survival water filter and books package. Anyway, I'm out of time. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.